into higher management. He doubted his superiors would care as long as he wasn't pulling workers away from their duties. Besides, corporate events honoring the troops were popular and suggested the corporation cared about the fighting men. Not that they do, Volker thought. He still shuddered at the thought of having to ride in one of the new jeeps a corporation had produced for the soldiers. They'd been so unprotected that a lunatic with a single pistol could do real damage. All they care about is money. The thought was a distraction, so he turned it over and over in his mind as the whistle blew and he went to work. They'd been working longer hours recently, turning out fewer civilian cars and more military vehicles. Reading between the lines, he had a private suspicion that meant that the losses in South Africa were far higher than expected. Panzers would probably make short work of the insurgents, if the insurgents were fool enough to stand and fight. The Arabs had tried that in their rebellion, and it had ended very badly for them. He wasn't sure how many workers would turn up for his meeting, but when he entered the cafeteria, he was relieved to discover that over 50 workers had attended. Chances were that some of them had thought attendance was compulsory. The secretary had probably made it so, and weren't too keen on anything other than getting home to their wives and children. But the meeting wouldn't take long. He strode over to the jukebox, turned on a recording of one of Wagner's longer compositions, the only music they were allowed in the factory, and turned to face his audience. Thankfully, he knew most of them personally. And some of them have been grumbling over the increased hours, he thought, and about how little say we have in our own affairs. It was a risk, he admitted privately. He could be sacked on the spot for trying to form a non-governmental union, let alone discussing what had happened to Conrad. His bosses might be pleased with his work, but they wouldn't tolerate anything that smacked of worker power. It would threaten their grip on power. I'm sorry for asking you all to attend, he said curtly. Liana was too young to understand what was happening, but he had discussed his plans with Gerda, and she'd agreed that they had to take the risk. There is a matter I need to discuss with you. He took a breath, then pulled one of the leaflets out of his pocket and held it up. This is true, he said. My son is one of the wounded. My son was shipped back home to a hospital somewhere in Germany, and they never told me what happened to him. Now, I find out through my own contacts that he will probably never recover. There's nothing I can do. A low rumble of anger ran through the cafeteria. Volker might have been an SS officer once upon a time, but he was a popular and reasonable foreman who'd gone to bat for his subordinates more than once. None of his workers believed he deserved to lose a son. It gets worse, Volker added, once several workers had added their own stories. The demands on our time are likely to increase. He braced himself as he took the plunge. I think it's time to take our fate into our own hands. Chapter 22. Morgenstern Residence, Berlin. 5 August, 1985. Hilda Morgenstern would never have admitted it, at least not outside the privacy of her own mind, but there were times when she envied Gudrun and many of her other girlfriends. Their mothers might be strict. Their mothers might insist that dinner and house chores came before their studies. Their mothers might be willing to slap their faces if they talked back or disobeyed. And yet, none of them came close to Frau Morgenstern for sheer overbearing obnoxiousness, let alone a burning desire to climb the social ladder until she was the mistress of Berlin's social scene. Hilda, her mother called. Bring out the refreshments. Hilda groaned inwardly as she picked up the plate of homemade cakes and biscuits. She'd had to turn them out herself, while the foreign-born maids cleaned the house thoroughly, even though there hadn't been a speck of dust in sight, and carried them into the living room, where her mother was holding court in front of a gaggle of middle-aged ladies who had money and time on their hands. They eyed her doubtfully as she passed the plate of cakes around, then resumed their discussion. Hilda was only marginally surprised to hear that the topic of the discussion was the leaflets.
"I've located 7 families who have a son who has dropped out of touch," one middle-aged lady said.
Hilda had never tried to remember their names, if only because they came and went so quickly.
"My husband says that one of the foremen at his factory has also lost a son who was actually sent back to Germany, and no one told him."
"Shocking,"
Frau Morgenstern said.
"And what are we going to do about it?"
Hilda found a seat and listened as the discussion raged around the table, genteel politeness mixed with a strange kind of fear and excitement. Frau Morgenstern and her friends did everything. They baked cakes for bake sales, they organized school trips for needy children, they even collected money for wounded soldiers or war widows. Hilda had long since learned to dread the days when her mother came up with another idea for poking her overly long nose into someone's affairs. Making friends had never been easy when her mother had seen Hilda's friendships as just another foot in the door. She would have done anything to live on campus, as Sven and the boys did. At least, she'd be a long way from her mother.
"We need to support the mothers and wives who have lost sons and husbands," Frau Morgenstern said, finally. "But we also need to learn the truth about what's actually happening."
"The leaflet says that the government is lying to us," one of her friends pointed out.
She was someone important. Her husband was a big wheel in the Ministry of Finance, Hilda had been told, and wasn't particularly scared of the SS.
"We need to force them to tell the truth." "So, we need to get thousands of women to work with us," Frau Morgenstern said.
Her eyes were glinting with inspiration.
"A full-sized protest movement, just like they have in America."
Hilda swallowed. She had no way to know for sure what happened in America, but she did have a good idea how the SS would react to a public demonstration. The women would be greeted with clubs, whips, and machine guns. And yet, would the SS dare to fire on German womenfolk when German men had been taught it was their duty to protect the women? The SS might start a riot or mutiny just by giving the order to fire.
"We already have strong ties to the Sisters of Mercy," Frau Morgenstern added after a moment. "There's no reason we can't use this to attract more people to the cause."
"And get yourself some more power," Hilda thought cynically. "You don't give a damn about the dead or wounded soldiers. You just want to use their fates for your own purposes." She scowled inwardly. Her mother thought in terms of power and influence, rather than anything more feminine. No wonder her father spent as much time as he could at the office, working for the Ministry of Industry. When his wife wasn't building her own power base, she was nagging her husband to work on his. Hilda was sure that her mother's pestering had been what had turned her father's hair gray before his time. And yet, her mother's concept might actually work. Frau Morgenstern sat in the center of a spider's web of tiny organizations, each of which might provide a core of women willing to help force the government to change. She smiled at the thought of her mother nagging the Reichstag. Frau Morgenstern was a hellishly efficient nagger, and then considered the possibilities more carefully. Gudrun and the rest of their tiny group might have started the ball rolling, but it was clear that events were already moving out of control.
"Which is a good thing, isn't it?" she asked herself. "We have to keep our heads down for a while, so if someone else takes up the cause..."
She rose as her mother gestured to her, then hurried back into the kitchen to pick up the next tray of snacks. One of the maids was hastily pulling another cake out of the oven, her pale face marred where Frau Morgenstern had slapped her hours ago. Hilda felt a stab of pity. No one would give a damn if the maids were beaten to death. But she knew there was nothing she could do. The poor girls were Untermenschen. If they died while working in the Reich, her mother would just be able to get a couple more from the Reich Labor Commission.
"And they have to sleep in the outhouse," Hilda thought guiltily.
She'd looked into the outhouse once, when she'd been younger. It was dark, dank, and smelly. The maids had to take showers before they were allowed to enter the house. Mother can't even give them a proper bedroom. She picked up the tray and hurried back into the dining room. The discussion had turned into a working party, Frau Morgenstern taking ideas from her friends and working them into a coherent whole. Hilda would have been impressed if she hadn't been so worried about just what her mother would do once she had her protest groups organized. Or, for that matter, just what would happen if the SS arrested the women before they could do anything. Hilda had no illusions about her mother's backstabbing tendencies, and she had a nasty feeling that one or more of the well-dressed women sitting in the room shared them. A single word to the SS would be enough to bring Frau Morgenstern and her husband before a tribunal. And who knew what would happen then? A hand touched her shoulder. She flinched and looked up. A maid was standing just behind her, looking terrified.
"My lady, your father has returned home," the maid said.
Her voice was so quiet that Hilda had to force herself to listen just to make out the words.
"He requests your presence in his study." "I understand," Hilda said.
At least it was an excuse for not listening to the older women for the next few hours.
"Thank you."
She saw a disapproving expression flicker across her mother's face as she rose. One did not thank Untermenschen. And she knew she'd be in trouble later. But she did her best to ignore it as she hurried out of the room and headed up the stairs. Her father rarely talked to her. Hilda was sometimes surprised that her parents had managed to produce a single child, and she was torn between a surprised delight and a gnawing fear at the sudden summons. Bracing herself, she tapped on the door and stepped into her father's office.
"Hilda," her father said, looking up from his ledgers. "Sit."
Hilda nodded and sat down, resting her hands on her lap. She'd never been entirely sure of what her father did for a living, although she did know it was a high-paying job somewhere in the tangled web that made up the Ministry of Industry. And it granted social status as well, she knew, enough to turn her mother into a power on the social scene. It wasn't the kind of life Hilda wanted for herself. She hadn't gone to the university to become yet another gossipy housewife. But at least it made her mother happy. She studied her father thoughtfully as he reached the end of the page and closed the book with a resounding thud. Unlike her big mother, Arthur Morgenstern was actually quite a small man, with a tacky suit, graying hair, and a face that, she thought privately, resembled a weasel. She had wondered from time to time why her father hadn't hired someone to give him a makeover, but she supposed he was rich and important enough not to need one.
"Hilda," Arthur Morgenstern said, "I trust your marks are high as always."
Hilda hesitated just for a second. Her father wasn't a strong man, not in her opinion, although in some ways that was actually a blessing. She'd had friends with strong fathers, and they had all been married off as soon as they'd reached legal age, practically given to men their fathers had chosen. And he had never tried to discipline Hilda, leaving all such matters to her mother. She sometimes wondered if he really cared for either his daughter or his wife.
"My marks are high," she said finally. "I'm still planning to study computers if I can get into the classes."
"Good, good," her father said. He looked up suddenly. "I hope you are not playing games with your tutors."
Hilda colored. She'd heard the rumors about Professor Merkin. She had no idea who'd started them or why, but she had never touched or been touched by any of her tutors. Hell, as far as they knew, she hadn't even had a boyfriend. Being with Martin had been fun, but she knew her parents would have hauled her out of the university if they suspected, even for a second, that she was having an unsuitable relationship.
"No, father," she said. "They have been nothing but proper to me."
"Good,"
her father said. He cocked his head slightly.
I've heard a vague rumor that the leaflets came out of the university, Hilda. Would you care to comment?
I have heard the same rumor, Hilda said. He didn't suspect her, did he? She had no idea how he could have suspected her. Her parents practically treated her as an extension of themselves.
Father, I know no one at the university who would dare write such leaflets.
Your mother apparently received a copy, her father said. Did you give it to her?
No, father, Hilda lied. If he knew already, if one of the maids had reported her slipping it into the pile of letters for her mother, she was doomed. He'd pull her out of the university and send her to one of the finishing schools in Switzerland, where young female brains were turned into mush. It wasn't as if her parents couldn't afford the fees.
I wouldn't dare pass on one of those leaflets.
A sensible attitude, her father said blandly. Should you discover who happened to write the leaflets, Hilda, you will inform me at once.
Yes, father, Hilda said. She knew better than to argue openly. She'd just keep her mouth shut and pray the group was never uncovered by the SS.
May I ask a question?
You may, her father said after a moment. I do not, of course, promise to answer.
Hilda took a breath.
Are the claims in the leaflets true?
Of course not, her father said too quickly. They're lies. Lies put about to weaken the Reich. We had similar problems in the 60s with radicals who were influenced by American ideals. They were rapidly crushed.
He shook his head.
The fools who wrote and distributed these leaflets may think they are doing the right thing, he added, after a moment. They are young, of course. Only a youngster would have the conceit to believe they could change the world by distributing leaflets. They are wrong. They are very wrong. They are undermining the Reich itself, Hilda.
Hilda couldn't bring herself to meet his eyes.
Is that wrong?
Her father gave her a sharp look.
You studied Rome, didn't you?
Yes, father, Hilda said.
She'd found history boring, but she remembered a few details.
I had to read about the Romans for school.
Brutus killed Julius Caesar, her father said. Do you recall that part of the story?
Hilda shrugged. Her lessons had centered around the great Teutonic heroes who'd brought down the Italians and established, once and for all, that Germans would never be slaves as long as they stood united. She recalled Julius Caesar, but only in passing.
Brutus and his comrades had no plan for what would happen after Julius Caesar was brutally murdered, her father said after a moment. He had no idea how to capitalize on his success. So he did nothing as events slipped out of hand. And so, instead of the successful restoration of the Roman Republic, Emperor Augustus rose to power.
I see, father, Hilda said.
Go, her father said. I have a meeting now, but I'll see your mother and yourself at dinner time.
Hilda nodded, rose, and left the room. It might have been an accident, but her father had given her something to think about, and something, she knew, she would have to discuss with the rest of the group as soon as possible. Who knew what would happen if the Reich came apart at the seams?
You weren't seen, were you?
I don't believe so, Andrew Barton said.
Walking through the richest part of Berlin was far safer than trying to sneak through the suburbs.
As long as the papers you provided me are in good order, I shouldn't have been in trouble even if I had been stopped by the police.
He smiled as Arthur Morgenstern sat back in his chair. The man was deeply corrupt and desperate for ready cash. Slipping him a few $100,000 had been more than enough to turn him into a source, although, as always, Andrew had to remember that the SS might be playing him rather than the other way around. Morgenstern was genuine, as far as he could tell, but there was always a quiet, nagging doubt.
That's good, Morgenstern said after a moment. There have been developments.
Andrew took a seat and leaned forward.
What sort of developments?
Threats of a new set of trade unions and various corporations, Morgenstern said, and people whispering about those damnable leaflets.
Even my wife knows what they are.
I'm sorry to hear that, Andrew said sincerely. Frau Morgenstern would have made an excellent source if she hadn't been more determined to build up her own power base than assist the United States. And your daughter?
Denies everything, Morgenstern said.
He looked up suddenly.
Could you offer her a scholarship to Caltech?
I could arrange for her to be selected if she puts her name on the lists, Andrew said. The university would kick up a fuss, and the FBI wouldn't be any happier, but the OSS had more than enough clout to make sure that Hilda Morgenstern was safely out of the Reich for a couple of years. Does she have genuine potential?
Her marks are good, Morgenstern assured him. I'm sure she could pass the entrance exam.
That proved nothing, Andrew knew. Caltech would try to reject her if she didn't pass the exam, and they'd be furious if Andrew's superiors insisted on allowing her to attend anyway. But competition was fierce at Speer University, he had to admit. Hilda Morgenstern wouldn't have managed to get as far as she had if she hadn't had genuine talent along with her family's connections. Morgenstern sighed loudly.
First we had problems in France, now we have problems in the Reich itself, he added, leaning back in his chair. I don't like the idea of new trade unions.
I suppose you wouldn't, Andrew agreed. I thought they were banned.
Oh, they are, Morgenstern said. And the workers should know it. There are government unions to take care of their requirements, but they're ignoring the rules.
Andrew wasn't surprised. The only hint of socialism in Nazi Germany lay within the Nazi Party's name, National Socialism. In reality, the corporations made big donations to the Reich's government, and in exchange, all independent trade unions were banned. Anyone who tried to found one could expect to be fired and jailed, perhaps exiled to the East in short order. And yet, as the Reich's economy tightened and paychecks grew thinner, it was harder and harder for the bosses to intimidate the workers into silence. That could be a problem, he agreed dryly.
What have your masters decided to do about it?
Nothing as yet,
Morgenstern admitted.
I think they're hoping the whole problem will just go away.
They thought that before the Great Depression, too, Andrew reminded him. But it didn't.
No, it didn't, Morgenstern agreed.
He was frightened, Andrew realized. Given his position in the Ministry of Industry, he had good reason to know the full scale of the problem. Andrew hadn't been sure what, if anything, to make of the leaflets. But if Morgenstern was worried...
And if it doesn't go away, he said carefully, what do you think they'll do?
Something drastic, Morgenstern said. And I want my daughter out of the Reich before that happens.
Andrew nodded.
We'll see what we can do, he said.
But she will have to pass the exams, Herr Morgenstern. Anything else would be far too revealing. Chapter 23. Wielandhaus, Berlin. 6 August, 1985. Gudrun lay on her bed, staring up at the ceiling. Her parents hadn't been particularly demanding, much to her relief, ever since Conrad's father had called Gudrun's father and had a long and private discussion with him over the telephone. Gudrun hadn't been sure how her father would react, particularly if he realized that she'd known Conrad was crippled before his father had found out. But he'd largely left her alone, while her mother had only given her a handful of chores to do when she got home from the university. In some ways, it was a relief. But she had a nasty feeling that the Reichmark was about to drop. How long would it be before her father started nagging her to find a husband, or presented her with a list of suitable candidates? And Conrad was going to die. She'd known he wasn't going to recover completely if he ever made it off the life support machine, but she dared to hope that they might have a life together. Now, she could no longer cling to the illusion. Conrad's father would turn the machine off once he actually found his son. He wouldn't leave his son's shattered mind trapped in a crippled body. It wasn't fair. Gudrun's thoughts mocked her. No one had seriously considered telling Grandpa Frank that it was time to die, to go on to the next world, even though he was a disgusting old man. But what had Conrad done to deserve such injuries? He'd been young and strong, and the world was at his feet. And it killed him, she thought bitterly. How many times had he sat beside her on the bed, sneaking kisses despite the open door? She wasn't sure she could bring herself to kiss anyone ever again. She'd practically betrayed Conrad by kissing Horst, even though it had been in the heat of the moment. Conrad did everything right, and he was still betrayed by his own government. She wanted to sit up. She wanted to do something. But she couldn't muster the energy to do anything more than lie on the bed. There were chores she needed to do, she was sure, and homework she needed to finish before going back to the university. Yet, it was so hard to focus her mind. If her father saw her latest set of marks, he'd blow a fuse. Gudrun knew, without false optimism, that her grades had slipped badly. And yet, between the knowledge of what had happened to Conrad and her own work with the leaflets, it was hard to focus on her studies. What sort of future did she have if nothing changed? There was a tap on the door. She looked up. Her father was standing there, looking worried. Gudrun sat upright hastily and beckoned him into the room. She couldn't keep her heart from pounding, although she was fairly sure she wasn't in trouble. Her father rarely entered a room, unless she was. It was her mother who normally inspected it each weekend and snapped at her to clean up her mess, place clean clothes in the drawers, and wash her dirty outfits in the sink.
Gudrun, her father said, sitting on the bed next to her. I am truly sorry.
Thank you,
Gudrun said. She wasn't used to her father being sympathetic or understanding. Even when he'd bawled out the BDM matron, he'd given Gudrun a look that promised she'd be in hot water as soon as she got home.
Conrad meant everything to me.
Your mother means everything to me, her father said, uncomfortably. But if she died, she wouldn't want me to just give up.
Gudrun stared down at her hands.
I'm not feeling suicidal, father.
Good, her father said dryly. I'd hate to have to take you to the hospital.
Gudrun flinched. A person who showed suicidal tendencies could be committed to a mental health institution and held indefinitely. Gudrun had heard enough horror stories about what happened behind their locked doors to know she never wanted to step into one. Certainly not while there was breath in her body. She had heard of a couple of students who'd committed suicide under the pressure, but it was very rare. Students at the university weren't encouraged to wallow in self-pity.
I just don't want to think about anything else at the moment, she said carefully. He was proud of me, father. I don't want to let him down.
I'm proud of you, her father said.
You don't understand me, Gudrun thought. Her father had always gotten on better with his sons, taking them to play football and camping in the hills, while Gudrun had stayed with her mother.
You would have been happy if I'd been born male, too.
I approved of Conrad, her father said, after a moment. SS he might have been, but he was a good lad, and would have taken care of you.
I don't need a man to take care of me, Gudrun snapped. I'm not going to be a housewife.
Her father gave her a long, considering look.
And if you graduate with the highest marks in your class, he said, what will happen then?
There aren't enough computer experts in the Reich, Gudrun said.
She allowed a hint of sarcasm to run through her voice.
I may be a weak and feeble woman, father, but they won't be able to dismiss me because I was born the wrong gender.
I hope you're right, her father said. But you do need to consider finding a new husband.
Gudrun stared at him.
It was easy to sound horrified and tearful.
"Conrad isn't even dead yet."
"But he will be," her father said, wrapping an arm around her shoulders. "And even if they keep him on life support, he will not be a suitable husband. He will not be able to father children."
Gudrun shuddered. She did not want to have that discussion with her father. Her mother had discussed how babies were made when she'd bled for the first time. She remembered that it had almost been a relief because she'd been convinced she was desperately ill, and the BDM had explained it in clinical detail, but discussing it with her father would be far too embarrassing. She recalled Conrad's bandaged body, lying in the hospital bed, and shuddered again. His genitals had been blown off by the blast. She took refuge in anger.
"Father, is having children the sole purpose of my life?"
Her father frowned.
"You are a young woman," he said. "The longer you wait before having children, Gudrun, the harder it will be to get pregnant and bring the child to term. If you wait too long, you simply won't be able to have children."
"And if I do," Gudrun said, "I'll be trapped in the house."
"Your mother rules the house," her father pointed out.
"But she is trapped," Gudrun countered. "She has to look after three little brats who don't do anything to help."
"You had your own bratty stage," her father said sarcastically.
"That's not the point," Gudrun said. "Kurt, Johann, and Siegfried do nothing around the house. They don't even pick up the trash in their rooms. Johann and Siegfried threw a fit when Mother told me to clean their room, but they weren't willing to do it for themselves. And even if Mother goes back to work when Siegfried turns 18 and gets a job of his own, she'll have given up the best years of her life."
Her father's face darkened.
"If she hadn't had children," he said, "you wouldn't exist."
"I know," Gudrun said.
It was true, after all. There was no point in trying to deny it.
"But I want to be something more than a housewife and mother, endlessly picking up after my children."
"You're a young woman," her father said. "You were born to be a mother."
"It doesn't seem fair," Gudrun objected.
How could she expect her father, the lord and master of the household, to understand?
"Why do I have to be a mother?"
Her father gave her a long look.
"No one would expect you to go to work," he said, after a moment. "You're not expected to go to war, or work in a factory, or do anything to bring in money for your family. Your husband, Gudrun, will be considered a failure if he doesn't ensure you have everything you need. He will be roundly mocked if his wife is in rags and his children are naked."
"And then he will get drunk and take it out on his wife," Gudrun said.
She'd never seen her father hitting her mother, but she'd known a couple of girls in school who'd had terrifyingly violent fathers. No one had cared when they'd come to school sporting nasty bruises they refused to talk about, let alone show to the matrons.
"And the wife has no rights at all."
She looked down at her hands. The BDM matrons had gone over the responsibilities of a wife in some detail, assuring their charges that a proper housewife was loyal, obedient, and never complained, let alone committed adultery. If she did, Gudrun had been told, she could expect to lose custody of the kids if she didn't wind up in jail. Gudrun recalled asking just why the husband was allowed to commit adultery if his wife didn't have the same rights and being forced to write lines as punishment. Her mother hadn't found it very amusing when Gudrun, her hand aching, had been sent home with a note. In hindsight, Gudrun couldn't help wondering if her mother's angry reaction had been fueled by her awareness of her own helplessness.
"That's not always true," her father said. "There have been men who've defended battered wives."
"But the wives don't get to defend themselves," Gudrun said.
Something would have to be done, she was sure. Women's rights were just another issue for the next leaflets, once they readied themselves to distribute a second set.
"They may not be lucky enough to have defenders."
You'll have me, her father said, and your brothers. They won't hesitate to come to your defense.
Siegfried might, Gudrun muttered. Her little brother blamed her for the thrashing he'd received from their father 5 days ago. He hates me.
He'll get over it, her father assured her. I thought I hated my sisters too once upon a time.
He cleared his throat.
I understand that you are in mourning, he said, and I will give you as much time as I can. But you do need a husband.
Gudrun shook her head mutely.
I'm not going to let you run free without a man, her father said firmly. You are young, beautiful, and intelligent. You'll have no trouble finding another boyfriend.
Widows get at least a year before they're expected to remarry, Gudrun muttered.
You're not a widow, her father pointed out. And you're not pregnant.
Gudrun rolled her eyes, even though she knew it would annoy him. The whole system was strange, at least when she applied logic and reason. She knew she wasn't supposed to have sex before marriage, but her father wouldn't have objected if she became pregnant out of wedlock, provided she married her boyfriend before she started to show. No one would be particularly surprised when a bride proved able to produce a child quicker than a properly wedded wife. But then, producing the next generation of Germans is an important goal, she thought, recalling the BDM's lectures. It was their duty, as maidens, to marry, have children, and raise them to become good little servants of the Reich. A handful of girls becoming pregnant before marriage, as long as there was a marriage, was hardly a problem. They just want us to have babies and raise them. Her father gave her a brief hug.
I know this is hard for you, he said.
Gudrun rather doubted that he did understand.
But your time is running out.
And if I don't find someone, Gudrun thought nastily, you'll find someone for me. Her father rose and headed out the door, leaving her behind. Gudrun shook her head tiredly, then rose herself. There were chores to do, after all, and they would keep her from thinking about her prison. Find a man, any man, or accept her father's choice. Who knew what sort of young man he'd consider suitable? A policeman? Or a soldier? Gudrun wasn't sure she could bear the thought of being married to a soldier, not after what had happened to Conrad. What was the point of building a life together if it could be snatched away in the blink of an eye?
Maybe I should ask Horst, she thought, as she headed downstairs.
He was smart, after all, and unlikely to be sent into danger. The Reich didn't have enough computer experts to risk losing one on the front lines. At least he'd understand why I had to keep spreading leaflets around.
Gudrun, her mother called. Can you go clean Grandpa Frank's room?
You should go do it yourself, Gudrun thought rebelliously. Perhaps she'd refuse to take her parents in once they were no longer capable of taking care of themselves. But she knew her mother wouldn't allow her to escape the job.
You don't want to handle your father yourself.
Gritting her teeth, she hurried back up the stairs and knocked at Grandpa Frank's door, then opened it to peer inside. The old man was sitting in the armchair, reading the newspaper. He looked surprisingly active for someone who drank several bottles of beer a day, and yet, when she started to scoop up the bottles, she discovered they were full. Her grandfather hadn't drunk any of his ration of alcohol.
"Pour them down the sink,"
Grandpa Frank ordered.
He sounded sober, too.
"Or just stick them back in the fridge."
Gudrun eyed him.
"You're sober."
Grandpa Frank gave her a sarcastic look.
"Would you rather I was drunk?"
"No,"
Gudrun said after a moment. Grandpa Frank knew. If he got drunk, if he blurted it out in front of her parents, she was dead. Her father would drag her out of university, marry her off to some knuckle-dragging moron, and deny he'd ever had a daughter.
"But I thought you needed the drink."
"I find that confession unburdens the mind," Grandpa Frank said.
He put the newspaper down on the table,
and smiled at Gudrun, rather unpleasantly.
Not that I ever set foot in a church after I returned from the war. I had the impression I'd be violently rejected after everything I'd done.
Gudrun nodded, although she didn't really understand. The Reich didn't encourage church attendance. Indeed, families who did attend church regularly could expect to be asked some pretty harsh questions. She knew very little about organized religion, save for what she'd been taught in school, and much of what she'd been taught, she suspected, was outright lies. Had the great Christian, Jesus Christ, really been killed by the evil Jews? Or was there something more to the story? And just what had really happened on Christmas Day? She finished cleaning the room, thankfully a sober grandfather meant less mess, and piled the rubbish into a small bag. Her mother didn't seem to have noticed that her father was sober, although that proved nothing. Gudrun hadn't been paying much attention to much of anything over the last few days. She gave her grandfather a sidelong look, then took a breath and leaned forward. If he was sober, maybe he could answer a question or two.
"Father wants me to marry soon," she said. "Is there any way I can dissuade him?"
Grandpa Frank shrugged.
"You're a healthy young woman," he said after a moment. "It is natural for you to have a husband. Your father won't be there to look after you for the rest of your life."
"I don't want to get married," Gudrun said. Not like this. I want to finish my education and get a proper job."
"You could always have 4 children very quickly,"
Grandpa Frank suggested.
"You'd be able to apply for a maid once you won the Mutterkreuz, and then you could go back to your studies."
"I don't think I'd be allowed to let the maid raise the children," Gudrun said.
Only very wealthy families could afford to hire German maids.
"And my husband might start eyeing the maids."
"Standards have slipped,"
Grandpa Frank agreed, dryly.
"Make sure you get the maids fixed before you allow them to sleep in your house."
Gudrun shuddered. She didn't want to think about her future husband, assuming she ever had one, sleeping with the maids.
"But you have other problems,"
Grandpa Frank added.
"Have you done anything else?"
"Not yet," Gudrun said.
The university was buzzing with talk, but most of it was nothing more than talk.
"I don't know how to proceed."
"You need to make alliances outside the university,"
Grandpa Frank told her curtly.
"If there's just a handful of you, the SS will find it easy to isolate and crush your little band."
"I see," Gudrun said.
She shook her head.
"But every time we try to make contact with someone else, we run the risk of being uncovered."
"Then make the invitation public,"
Grandpa Frank said.
"You'll need to concentrate on leaderless resistance, not establishing a strict hierarchy. That's what destroyed the French resistance. We captured a couple of leaders and forced them to betray their comrades."
Gudrun nodded slowly.
"Thank you, Grandpa."
Grandpa Frank shrugged.
"Bring me some coffee,"
he said. He waved his hand dismissively.
"And see if you can fill a couple of bottles with water for me."
"I'll do my best," Gudrun said.
Coffee was growing more expensive, according to her mother.
"At least water is still free."
Chapter 24. Albert Speer University, Berlin. 7 August, 1985. If Horst had been genuinely interested in rooting out dissidents, he would have filed a whole series of complaints about the transfer students he was forced to supervise. They were laughably underprepared for their roles. Indeed, they fitted in so badly that he couldn't help wondering if his superiors had deliberately intended to make their watching eyes so noticeable that even a rank amateur would have spotted them before they opened their mouths. Maybe their real goal was to divert attention away from Horst and his fellow agents, the men and women who actually blended into the university's population. It was, he felt, the only explanation that suggested his superiors weren't terrifyingly incompetent. And no one pays any attention to us, he thought, while the goons make their way through the university. It was clear, astonishingly clear, that none of the new students had any real experience with academic life, let alone pass the exams necessary to attend the university as new students. No one could possibly mistake them for real students, and, if that wasn't bad enough, they were crashing through the classrooms, asking so many dumb questions that Horst was tempted to report them as potential dissidents. He couldn't help wondering if some of the other spies, the ones who weren't charged with supervising the assholes, had already reported them. It wouldn't be the first time that an intelligence operation had been ruined by two different people working at cross purposes. At least they know not to bother me on campus, he thought, as he left the lecture hall and headed up to the meeting room. That would have blown their cover as well as my own. He caught sight of one of the spies looming over a young girl and sighed inwardly. Of all the people they had to send, did they really have to send someone so entitled that he thought he could press his attentions on a student? Horst had met his kind before, the men who thought that being in the SS gave them license to harass any woman they liked. He had no doubt that the idiot would blow his cover sooner rather than later. After all, the poor girl would probably report him to the university authorities, who wouldn't be able to expel him because of his connections. Idiot, he thought. He briefly considered reporting that to his handlers, then dismissed the thought. A corps of visible spies was more useful than a handful of agents who genuinely blended into their surroundings. Unless, of course, the visible spies were meant to distract attention from the invisible spies. And if the game was that easy, anyone could play. He pushed the thought out of his mind as he walked up the stairs and stepped into the meeting room. Half of the group, it struck him suddenly that they still didn't have a proper name, was missing, unable to get away from classes or practical work to attend. Horst understood there were just too many outsiders tramping through the university for them to risk doing anything out of the ordinary, even though the meetings were important. Sven sat at one end of the table next to Hilda. Gudrun sat at the other end, looking tired and wan. Horst couldn't help feeling a flicker of concern. Unlike him, she hadn't been trained for long periods of stress, with the risk of capture permanently looming over her shoulder. "We should be safe now," he said, once he'd closed the door and turned the jukebox on, deafening the bug with American music. He had no idea if someone, anyone, was actually listening through the bug, but better safe than sorry. "There are at least 9 new spies within the student body."
"I noticed," Gudrun said.
She sounded vaguely amused.
"That Rudolph has never touched a computer in his life. He sat next to me in the lab and stared at it before the professor showed him how to turn it on."
Horst smiled.
"That isn't uncommon in the East," he said. "Computers? What can you do with a computer that you can't do with a gun? Farming tools and a great deal of grit, spunk, and determination."
"Play computer games," Sven said wryly. "Send messages across the entire continent in the blink of an eye. Access files everywhere and change them if necessary."
"True," Horst agreed.
German bureaucracy was famed across the entire world for sheer bloody-minded thoroughness. There were copies of SS files right across the Reich. He knew, if he walked into an office in Germany South, the officers on duty would be able to access a copy of his file and confirm his identity with ease.
"But they rarely see anything more advanced than a tank or a CAS aircraft."
He shrugged as he sat down.
"There have been other developments," he added. "Have you heard about the unions?"
Sven smiled.
"My father's a member at the plant," he said. "He's been bitching for months about having to work longer hours for less pay. Now he's banding together with most of his fellows to demand higher pay and shorter work hours."
I'm not sure he'll get anywhere if he demands more money for less work, Hilda said quietly. My mother has been organizing protests through her network of female organizations. She's even been gathering information from the Sisters of Mercy. The crisis is far worse than we assumed.
Things are moving faster, Gudrun said. She didn't sound as enthusiastic as Horst would have expected. How do we make them slow down?
We don't, Horst said. The government isn't going to slow its response to suit us.
Hilda leaned forward.
Are we doing the right thing?
Yes, Gudrun snapped.
My father said that we were weakening the Reich, Hilda said after a moment. That we were fools who were threatening order and stability.
That's an interesting argument, Horst said.
He'd actually expected the government to use a similar line to dismiss the leaflets, even though it would have been a de facto confession that the leaflets actually existed.
But tell me, will anything change if we do nothing?
He took a breath.
The government got us into a war that seems to be unwinnable. The government is lying to us, and the government has no reason to change, he added after a moment. We have to force them to change before the whole edifice breaks apart and shatters.
So, what do we do? Hilda asked. If we win?
We worry about it when we win, Horst said dryly.
The leaflets might have upset the government, but they hadn't really threatened its grip on power.
You do realize the odds of us ending up hanging from meat hooks are alarmingly high.
True,
Gudrun said. She sounded more cheerful, although it was apparent that something was bothering her.
So, what do we do about the unions?
I can use the computer network to spread the word, Sven offered. The corporations are quite dependent on computers these days, and their security is terrible. Blinking messages through the network shouldn't be that hard.
Then do it, Gudrun said.
Do more than that, Horst said. He smiled rather coldly. Put out rumors as well, rumors that will be believed. The corporations are about to cut wages again. The demand for production is about to skyrocket. Rumors that will be believed by the people at risk.
Perhaps even add a suggestion that hundreds of workers are going to be fired, Gudrun offered. Maybe even replaced with Untermenschen.
Sven looked doubtful.
They wouldn't believe that, would they?
Horst snorted.
What makes you think the corporations wouldn't replace their labor force with Untermenschen if they thought they could get away with it?
Write out a list of rumors and start spreading them, Gudrun said.
We need more than that, Horst said. People will only move if they believe that they will not move alone, Gudrun. We need to create a legend. We need something people will believe in, an organization that unites all the disparate interest groups against the government.
A brotherhood, Sven said. A super union, Horst agreed.
We need a name for ourselves and a figurehead.
Gudrun frowned.
The Reich Reform Commission?
I'd have thought something more striking, Horst said.
The Valkyries, perhaps. And their leader, Sigrun.
That might work, Gudrun said thoughtfully.
You'd be Sigrun, Horst told her. There were few Germans alive who wouldn't be aware of the name's origins. They'd all been forced to study the Norse myths in school. We'd issue proclamations in your name, using them to create an impression of vast numbers and, in doing so, make them true.
That would tell the government our leader was a girl, Sven objected.
They'd be unlikely to believe it, Horst assured them. Why would they believe it? They don't think much of women.
My mother is likely to take advantage of that, Hilda observed. She's already starting new groups.
We need to work on women's rights, too, Gudrun said. Get all of the women on our side.
Horst nodded. Shall we work on the first proclamation?
He'd been told years ago that a committee was the only animal in existence with multiple bodies and no brain. It wasn't something he'd really understood until the four of them had put their heads together and drafted out the first set of demands. Free elections, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of association, an end to the war in South Africa, and, above all, an end to the climate of fear.
Horst had to admit, as he read the prelude, that Gudrun knew how to turn a phrase. She might lack the polish of the writers who wrote the regime's propaganda, but that only made it stronger. Her words came from the heart. "Upload it onto the network," Gudrun said, when they were finally finished. "And, for God's sake, don't let any of the spies see you typing it into the computer."
"We'll need to print out more leaflets, too," Horst observed, "and then start scattering them around the city."
"Maybe we can hide them around the university," Sven said, "with notes, asking the finders to hand them out. They wouldn't have any direct link to us if they got caught."
"True," Horst said. "But be careful this time, understand. No fingerprints."
He threw a look at Gudrun as Sven and Hilda left the room, motioning for her to stay. She looked oddly reluctant. He wondered if she was still embarrassed about the kiss, but remained seated, studying her fingertips as if they were the most fascinating thing in the universe. Horst checked the door, then sat down next to her. If anyone glanced inside, they'd hopefully assume that Horst and Gudrun had found a private place for some alone time. He just hoped the spies didn't see them together.
"Conrad's father is involved with the unions," he said flatly.
Gudrun's eyes went wide.
"Are you sure?"
"I have a friend who's just joined up," Horst lied.
In reality, his handler had told him that Volker Schulze had already been tagged as a union leader by the SS, and ordered Horst to watch for anyone at the university who might have a connection to him.
"Volker Schulze may not be the sole leader, but he's definitely involved. Tell me, your engagement to Conrad?"
"Is over," Gudrun said bitterly. "His father terminated it."
Horst hesitated, unsure what to say. He liked Gudrun. If things had been different, perhaps he would have courted her himself. And there had been that kiss. The nasty part of his mind was almost tempted to applaud. But Gudrun had loved Conrad, and he hadn't deserved to wind up a cripple, alone and helplessly dependent on a life support machine. She certainly didn't deserve to lose her boyfriend so casually, to have her relationship dismissed by his father. The only consolation was that it wasn't a declaration that she wasn't suitable as a prospective bride.
"I'm sorry to hear that," he said.
He practically swallowed his tongue to keep from pointing out that Gudrun and Conrad would never have been able to have a normal life together. A young man as badly wounded as Conrad was nothing more than a drain on the Reich. Some bean-counting bureaucrat who had never met him would order the life support turned off sooner or later.
"But I need to know. Was your engagement ever formalized?"
"Not really," Gudrun admitted after a moment. "We'd exchanged letters, of course, but we hadn't registered the engagement."
Horst let out a breath he hadn't realized he'd been holding.
"So there's nothing formal to tie you to Conrad?"
"No,"
Gudrun said miserably. She looked up suddenly.
"Do you think they might draw a line between myself and Conrad's father?"
"It's a possibility," Horst admitted.
He'd gone through the files as thoroughly as he dared, but he hadn't been able to tell if anyone had reported an intruder visiting Conrad's bed. The SS already believed that the leaflets had come from the university. If they knew about Gudrun and Conrad, they'd certainly have grounds for hauling Gudrun into the RSHA for a long interrogation session.
"You need to consider the prospect of someone asking you a few questions."
"Conrad wasn't a student," Gudrun objected.
"They know the leaflets came out of the university," Horst said.
He covered for his slip instantly. There wouldn't be so many spies in the building if they didn't know. They must have figured out that the professor they arrested was innocent, or at least that he had nothing to do with the leaflets. Gudrun snorted rather sourly. Horst understood. He had no idea who'd started the rumors about the arrested professor sleeping with some of his students, but they just wouldn't go away. It was a standard tactic, undermining the professor's reputation to make it harder for anyone to defend him. And it seemed to be working. The students were still discussing the leaflets,
but very few of them still respected the professor.
"I'll watch myself," Gudrun assured him finally, "and I won't tell them anything."
"Just stick to the basics," Horst said,